When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
It was the sound of his voice over the phone. He was so confident and sure that I should be doing this movie with him. And I was not going to tell him no. But when he presented the idea, I was like, this is crazy. I think you're crazy. Maybe you could find someone a little bit who would have an easier job doing this. He's like, I think how difficult it's going to be for you is what's going to be interesting about it. Pablo's perspective has so much compassion in it because of how extreme it is. I think to really honor a woman's feeling, all of the things that make you feel crazy in the moment. When you're going through trauma, sometimes internally that landscape is crazy. And instead of talking about it, he actually represented those in pictures. You know what I mean? Like instead of being like, I just feel like ripping off my necklace and eating it. It's like, well, then rip it off and eat it.
Hello, and welcome to The Awardist from Entertainment Weekly, taking you inside this year's top contenders for the Oscars and more of the industry's biggest awards. I'm Clarissa Cruz, EW's executive editor. I'm joined by my co-host, Josh Rothkopf, EW's senior movies editor. Hey, Josh.
Hey. Today, we have a special guest with us, EW critic Leah Greenblatt. Hi, Leah.
Hello.
Hello. On today's episode, we are going to be presenting our interview with Kristen Stewart, who is just so extraordinary in Spencer and Oscar nominated. But before we get to that, we are going to talk about two things, primarily the Best Actress race, but also the foreign film race, which I guess I should call the international film race, not foreign. The category name was changed. And Leah Greenblatt wrote a beautiful essay about this, and the foreign film bracket is extremely strong this year. Five films that I think could stand up to the Best Picture nominees. Leah, do you have a favorite among the five?
You know, yes, I do. But I actually have a Sophie's Choice, which is okay. Between Drive My Car and Worst Person in the World. I can't stand the thought of either of them losing, but there were so many things that didn't even make the cut for nominations. There was a ton of movies that I loved that were international that I just thought were so good this year. So we should talk about what is up for it, right? Which is Worst Person in the World, Drive My Car, Lunana, A Yak in the Classroom, which has real yak. actually quite a movie star of a yak. Hand of God, which is not a surprise because Paolo Sorrentini has already won this, of course, for The Great Beauty. I think that was 2013. Yeah. And Italy, I should say, has by far the most wins. I think they have 11 in what was formerly known as Best Foreign Film. And Europe obviously just tends to dominate because, well, we know why. We don't have to dig too much into that. But as the Academy has become more diverse, as the world has become more aware of diversity, and as some of these borders have kind of fallen away, we've gotten all these, I mean, Lunana, A Yak in the Classroom, that's from Bhutan. That's the first time that Bhutan as a country has ever, I think, even submitted or made it this far on the list, and let alone get a nomination. But there was so many movies that I truly loved this year or just wanted to see recognized. I don't know if you can say you love To Ten because it is an extremely violent movie about a girl who kills people with picks and has sex with a car. But I love that it exists. This movie won the Palme d'Or at Cannes. Like I can never tell whether or not I should recommend it, but I love to talk about it. A great little German movie called I'm Your Man, which again, won a bunch of prizes in Europe, which is about a lonely research scientist who reluctantly agrees to take in an AI man, a robot, basically a love robot who's been designed to her specifications. And he is played by Dan Stevens from Downton Abbey and various other projects, who happens to speak fluent German. I didn't know that till I saw the movie. A Hero, a beautiful movie from Iran, again, which you have a two-time Oscar winner in Best Foreign for that. Lamb. Loved Lamb from Iceland. Wow, yes. That's Noomi Rapace as one of our favorite Scandinavian actresses, and basically terrifying, set on a remote homestead in Iceland, and it involves a lamb child. And I'm going to stop talking because you don't want to spoil anything else about that movie.
And then also the fifth nominee, which I don't think we've mentioned yet, which is Flea.
Flea.
Oh, right? Well, Flea. Okay, so Flea is up for 3 Oscars, am I right? It's up for Best Documentary, Best Animated Film, and Best Foreign. And I would be okay if it won all of them. I think it should be up for Best Picture. But I think it has no chance in animation, most likely, right? Because that's Pixar land, and that will go to one of the big kids. It'll go to Disney or whatever. But it is animated. It is a documentary, and it is the beautiful story from Norway via Afghanistan, made by a Norwegian filmmaker, pegged to his best friend from high school, who he knew had somehow emigrated from Afghanistan, from Kabul, under very sort of sketchy, war-torn circumstances, but didn't know how, and made a movie to find out the story. I love this movie.
Yeah, and also just creatively, it's just such a fascinating idea, the idea that in the absence of having actual footage of his exodus, and which sounds crazy to me, we watch Flea and just what someone a boy's age would have to go through, but also realizing that animation is the perfect way to imagine that tale is, I think, a really smart decision in terms of the filmmaking.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of documentaries, I feel like, that tell you stories you need to hear that are important. And I think this is important, and it's extremely intersectional in ways that you'll see as you watch the film. But it's a piece of art. To me, it's gorgeous, and there's so much joy in this movie. And a lot of that, I think, stems from this 20 years of friendship between these two guys, you know, and the fact that his subject, who uses a pseudonym for reasons that are also clear once you see the movie, uses only his first name, right? I think that is his real first name. But I came out of this movie like I felt like I was maybe like 3 feet off the ground. I was floating. And again, 90 minutes, and he nails it. Some of the best films in here are actually very tight. So is I'm Your Man. What is not tight is Drive My Car, but I could spend those 3 hours again and again in a time loop somewhere outside of Tokyo. I just, God, this movie. And you know what? I had to be forced to see it, I have to say. It took me a few false starts to go see it because I just thought, 3 hours of subtitles.
Did you see it in a theater or did you see it on your computer?
I saw it in a gorgeous theater at a film festival where I was on the jury and we had finished our jury duties. And I thought, I am going to just see one thing for myself. And I went home swooning back to my hotel. And I just remember wanting to tell everyone about it.
Everyone's daunted when they hear the 3 hours, and then they start watching it, and it's like no one mentions it after that.
You're absolutely right, right? That they shut up about it as
and
soon
then
as they
shut up.
Yeah, it flies, right? It's a question of the pacing, and you don't even really. And also, people don't have. I mean, we certainly complain about the lengths of movies, but we have seen a lot of 3 hour long movies, especially in 2021, I feel.
I remember, nothing feels longer than Belfast.
That's a good segue into, you know, when you first pitched this story about the foreign film essay that ran in our April issue, you know, you're like, best international film, the category is stronger than best picture, you know, in a lot of ways. And I love that thought. And you know, you mentioned Belfast, but what are some of the things that, that made you think that when you looked at this?
Look, I enjoy a lot of the movies that are nominated for best picture. And I think in a lot of ways, typically they are foreign films. Power of the Dog is absolutely a product of New Zealand. And I think anyone who doesn't see that, from the cinematography to Jane Campion's direction, and of course you have a very sort of motley cast of, you know, mostly all Western actors, but I don't know, like, a Dune, obviously made by the extremely French Canadian Denis Villeneuve, who until a few years ago hardly spoke much English. I remember hearing Amy Adams say on the set of Arrival that most of what he was doing was like semaphores to try to get her to give her director notes because he didn't really have the language yet. But there's a lot of amazing aspects to these films, but a lot of the stuff that to me is in Best Picture this year, I would reward for the screenplay or the cinematography or the acting, but they don't feel like movies that in 2 years or 5 years or 10 years, I'm going to be saying, man, that sure was the Best Picture of 2021. I'm going to say Worst Person in the World, and I'm going to say Drive My Car, and I'm going to say Flea. Those, I think, are the movies that would stick with me. And not because I'm a film critic or whatever, but because they're such beautiful, universal movies. It is not homework to watch these movies as long as you're, you know, okay with the subtitles, which by now, hopefully, Parasite has broken some of that down for us and a number of other films from the last few years that have just helped kind of foment a sea change and all that.
Yeah, there's also a sense that among those foreign films you mentioned, they feel more complete than a lot of the Best Picture nominees. Like they feel like perfectly conceived things. Some of them are 3 hours long. Some of them are nice and tight, but they don't leave you hanging. They don't leave you wondering, or rather they leave you with ideas to think about and you complete the journey on your own. Whereas I think literally in the case of Dune, say, this is the first
half a movie,
half a story, and we definitely need
a long ass half, but it's a half,
right? It's a long ass half, and even something like The Power of the Dog, which I think people are trying to fit into this Best Picture mold because it's, you know, a statement about America or whatever, or it's a Western, which always suggests something larger. But there is something kind of, you know, it's obviously a very suggestive movie, whereas the international features that you've been discussing, God, they create a universe and they go as far as they need to in that and they explore it so fully. I think about The Hand of God too, which I think could fit into this idea of directors exploring in an autobiographical sense their past. It's something that's happened a bit this year. You could also talk about Paul Thomas Anderson's Licorice Pizza in that extent. But the idea of a director going back
to Souvenir Part 2.
Right, exactly. Souvenir Part
Belfast,
2.
Belfast, too, really. Yeah, they all...
Belfast, yeah. Well, can we talk about the Yak? Because I feel like that's the one that I know least about.
That's an important thing.
That,
yes.
I don't know that anyone had their money on this one making the final cut. Josh, were you surprised to see Lunana in the...
Yeah, I was.
That's the wild card, I feel like.
I love a lot of the other foreign language films that you mentioned that didn't quite make that fifth slot.
Who do you think it took the slot away from?
Oh, a hero, I think, because he'd won twice, you know. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's also because watching A Hero, as much as I love Farhadi's work and, you know, so much of
it. We should say what else he's made. Sorry, A Separation.
Yes, right,
he won
right,
an Oscar
a
for
separation
that.
With, yes.
For a director from Iran to win two, you know, that I think it's maybe two of the only Iranian Oscars.
I think it is.
I thought that was a shoo-in, honestly, A Hero. And that's a very kind of like, it's sort of a morality tale, I would say, without judgment, but it's about a guy, you know, an incredible actor who's in prison, but it's not quite a prison as we know it. It's a debtor's prison. And it looks a little bit like a rundown YMCA to me, but he finds a way to maybe get out of there by a heroic act. By the act of finding a woman's purse full of gold coins and returning it to her, and it doesn't go how he planned, and it's again a gorgeous movie. But a thing I think is interesting too is that some of these, one big difference I would say from the last 5-10 years is that these films, a lot of them are going to Netflix, Hulu, Amazon Prime, so people are actually seeing them. You don't have to live in a town that has like an arty little theater where you can see this stuff. You can literally go to Netflix and right next to Squid Game and The Maid and whatever is Hand of God, just sitting there waiting for you.
They've been doing a really excellent job, actually, of acquiring a lot of movies, almost to the point where they get lost. They also had Lost Daughter, The Disciple. They released Happy as Lazaro. They didn't really release it, but I wish they had gotten behind it more. But I think also watching A Hero, maybe you guys differ on this, but it was such an enervating, nerve-wracking experience watching this film. I think that's why it didn't make the fifth bracket.
I think so too. I walked out of it and I had, my face was the emoji that looks like the Munch painting. You know, I was just like, because the world was so hard at the moment that I saw it a few months ago. I think, you know, there was another surge, Omicron, whatever. And I just thought, ooh, I needed a happy ending, and that's not what I got.
Right.
So I do agree with you, and I think that's why Lunana slipped in, because it is a very gentle movie. It is very tender and sweet, and it's life-affirming. And I think the most life-affirming thing I saw this year were Flea, Worst Person in the World and Drive My Car, but in a simpler, more straightforward way, I think Lunana spoke to a lot of voters, I have a feeling. And Titan probably sent them screaming for the exits. same with a movie like Great Freedom, which I saw and loved. And that is, you know, a gay Nazi prison movie from Austria. So I don't know why it didn't make the cut. but I adored it. And I thought the acting was spectacular. And I will probably never see it again because it's a tough watch. But I love that it exists. And Compartment Number 6, we forgot to talk about that one.
Right,
Finland.
Right.
Another great movie. I mean, you guys, it's embarrassing, the riches that we got this year.
Amazing, amazing. Well, I mean, I guess we could move on to the next thing that we're talking about today. A woman that both of you have interviewed, Kristen Stewart, Leah for our November fall movie preview cover story, and Josh for this episode of the podcast. Let's talk about Kristen.
I actually saw her last night for a screening that she's doing on her way to the Oscars. And I asked her how she felt about the nomination, Josh. I don't know if you did too. And she said she was very much looking forward to watching Olivia Colman accept.
Yes.
That's her answer when I asked her if she had a speech, because I said, you know, you are still the only American actress who's ever won a César, which is the French equivalent of an Oscar, which she won for mm-hmm. Clouds of Sils Maria. And kind of in a way, I think really helped her, I think led to Spencer, because Pablo yeah. Larraín, the director of Spencer, said he was a huge fan of Personal Shopper.
Yep.
And which yeah. is the other Olivia Assayas movie that she made after Clouds of Sils Maria. They had this collaboration, Kristen Stewart, and she's worked with all these, I mean, amazing directors, obviously.
Yeah.
Kelly Reichardt and Ang Lee and David Fincher. That's Panic Room, in case you want to Google it. I think that was her first major role, really, besides like a Flintstones movie. But yeah, this relationship between her and Pablo, I think, is sort of magical. And obviously, you know, he found something with Natalie Portman when he made Jackie. But the thing between them on Spencer seems like almost like, Josh, wouldn't you say, like one of those old sort of collaborations? It's like from the 70s sort of new cinema yep. when an actor mm-hmm. or an actress and a director would sort of mind meld mm-hmm. and make
You'll
art.
Hear it. Yeah, you'll hear this in the podcast that we're in the interview we're about to present. You'll hear this where she talked. I asked her, like, how did he reach out to you? And what was that? What was his vision for that lured you to do this role? And she talks about how his voice was really a compelling thing, just listening to him on the phone or the Zoom or whatever it was, and just how he just was so confident in this idea. So, yes, very 70s.
I can co-sign on that. I met him a couple times to discuss the movie because I was writing this cover story. And I met him first at Telluride. And I think we I sat there waiting to get a drink at the bar for maybe 45 minutes while he just poured out all of the reasons that he loved this movie and loved Kristen Stewart in it and needed her. And, you know, as an outsider, as two outsiders, he's Chilean. She's this American girl that obviously is known for very different types of roles and was, I think, 7 years old when Diana died. You know, so a lot of people thought they had no business making this movie, especially when all of these things are so in the moment with The Crown and all of these other sort of this sort of cult of Diana that was much more aimed on accuracy and sort of, you know, storytelling. And this is not that.
No, Kristen Stewart, she talked mm-hmm. specifically also about that, about the idea of how important it is to an actor when a director believes in them, regardless of the physiognomy or the contact lenses or the hair or the prosthetics. She uses none of that in Spencer. It makes this performance very different, say, from Nicole Kidman or Jessica Chastain. This is real acting where you just have to kind of embody it. And Pablo believed in her.
So she did use the same vocal coach as Naomi Watts and Emma Corrin from The Crown,
yeah,
because there's one guy who knows Diana's voice, because it's such a rarefied, posh, you know, there's like a couple thousand people that speak in that accent.
Yeah, but she really nails that, and it's a real deep dive for her. I understand that connection that she had with Pablo.
It's pretty hard not to connect with Pablo when you see his vision. And I think another thing that's fascinating about him, and we actually talked about this last night in this Q&A, for the movie, that Pablo Larraín and I think Sebastián Lelio, who's his fellow Chilean filmmaker, that he's made a lot of he's kind of a production partner too. And Sebastian made A Fantastic Woman, which won Best International, right? Mm-hmm. Was it 3 years ago? And made Gloria and all these wonderful movies. These are two Chilean men in their 40s who make amazing movies about women's inner lives.
Right.
Which I think is fascinating. Gloria, you know, he did the remake with Julianne Moore, which was one of my favorite movies of a couple years ago.
One of her best.
I remember that one, yeah.
And they make these movies where they let you sit in the stillness of these women. And especially like, you know, they don't all have to be famous women, obviously, even though Pablo happens to have done Jackie and Diana. He's not really interested in the fame so much as the impact of it and this sort of, like I said, the inner life. And so, like, I can't name that many American guys doing that. Can you? I mean,
no, I mean, although it's interesting, when I asked Kristen what she was really desperate to deflect the attention to some of the other Oscar films and other films being discussed, because she's so generous that way. And I asked her what she's loved lately, and she talked all about Alana Haim. So that's an example of like a woman's inner life and a male director paying a lot of attention to that. I think in it, similar to Laureen, who's, you know, sometimes it's not necessarily just a straightforward story. Sometimes it's focusing on a strange bit of costuming or a strange moment of silence, like you say, letting them exist in those silences and those moments. And that's how you really get to the psychology of a character.
Of course, didn't you say that when you spoke to Dakota Johnson, she couldn't shut up about Worst Person in the World and our girl, Renata, who we love so much.
Her doppelganger, we should say.
But.
I mean, that's interesting because, you know, once you said that they looked alike, that's all I could think about. Well, I had a question for either of you. If she talked about this either last night, Leah, or during your interview, Josh, but did she talk about the race at all? I would seem that she wouldn't want to, but she seems to have the most interesting trajectory, you know, out of the five best actress candidates, because she was such a strong, you know, early front runner. And then, you know, all of these snubs and nominations that she didn't get, you know, in some of the precursors. And then now she's back in. It just seemed like she had the wildest roller coaster. Did she talk about that at all?
I mean, besides saying that she was assured of Olivia Colman's win, she did say that she has never asked for anything, but she had to beg the Oscars to sit her with Pablo Larraín because of the strictures of this year, because so few people are allowed to attend the ceremony and they're being so careful about COVID. And she said she basically threw like the one and only diva fit of her life, saying, if we can't sit together, I won't go, basically, because I think they may have sent him to Siberia because he's not nominated for director. Mm-hmm. So they were putting him somewhere in the cheap seats. And she said, she took a stand on that, but I think she's very sanguine about it because it, you know, I mean, she didn't get the SAG nomination, right? Which people thought was like a sure thing. And obviously the game was a little off this year with the Globes not being a big predictor and stuff. But to me, I do think she's probably right that she's not a front runner at this point, but remember what happened with the sort of whiplash with Ben Affleck and Argo when he wasn't nominated. And then everyone was like, oh my God, we did him so dirty. And then they gave him everything at the Oscars. Mm-hmm. So I think sometimes that can help you. It's such a weird arc. And I think it's so strange because one thing I asked Kristen last night is I said, you know, you premiered this the first week in September in Venice, at the Venice Film Festival. So she's been working this movie for 6 months, just globetrotting. Yeah. And she's given a million interviews and somehow given unique quotes every single time that she speaks, which to me, like, give her the Oscar for that alone.
Yeah.
She doesn't want to talk about the race and the snubs.
No. She did say everyone wants to win. She said she's not going to lie about that.
Yeah.
But she's also, I mean, she comments in the interview you're about to hear that she's a movie geek and she loves the Oscars as much as we do. And she's been watching for years and years as well. And she is a little upset about the eight categories being pushed to the pre-show, just like we are. And she, you know, also understands that, you know, making art is a balance between, you know, making movies is a balance between art and commerce. And she has a longer view than most people her age because she's been on sets for 20 years, you know, and she is really kind of a veteran. This isn't like...
And her family, we should mention too, her whole family. Yeah, as she said, she grew up in the circus. But her family is all very sort of, I would say, sort of working class showbiz. You know, her brother, I think, is a gaffer or a grip, and her parents work in production stuff. And she, I think you're right. I think it's less about the starriness of it than the pure sort of love of the show. And P.S., like cinematography, all, you know, score, these things matter to anyone who loves movies. So the fact that they're eliminated, I'm really glad that the movie stars themselves are speaking out about that, because they know how that it takes a village, and they know that that stuff is an integral part of the movies they get nominated for and they get the glory for.
I asked Kristen about that specifically because she's about to direct her own feature for the first time, and she made a short film, but it's like she knows how important these quote unquote below the line people are. I hate using that term, but she doesn't use those terms either. I mean, I think it also the whole trajectory of snubs and knows where was she in sex, that was all created and spun by prognosticators. But the fact of the matter is, when people saw Spencer, like you did, Leah, in September, you know, or earlier, I think.
August, thank you.
August, there you get humble brag.
I just needed just to talk to her because I couldn't.
Yeah, and it's like, it's interesting how that really, I think what the takeaway from all of this is that, you know, quality and what critics say matters. And obviously people responded to Spencer, which is not a very straightforward biopic, but responded to its artistry, responded to it being a daring kind of a psychodrama and a plunge for her, and definitely a first for her in a lot of ways. And then, you know, I think the attention was dragged elsewhere to performances and movies that were a lot more commercial, a lot more conventional, and maybe a little more thirsty in terms of their appeal. I am implicitly talking about Lady
Name
Gaga.
Name names, Josh. Yeah.
Right. The critics, I think it was a pendulum that swung back to, you know, I think a lot of what the critical reaction was, you know. So Spencer and Kristen's job in it is, I think, going to stand the test of time. It's an amazing performance. And after the break, you'll hear our interview with Kristen Stewart. So stay tuned.
Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's kazoo concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's bachelorette bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Hi, Kristen. Welcome to The Awardist.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. First of all, congratulations on this incredible performance. I recently had this opportunity to watch Spencer again, and I was struck by how your Princess Di really desires connection, even when she's having arguments with the staff, even when it's antagonistic. Those exchanges are kind of drawn out, and it kind of made me wonder if this was something in the forefront of your mind, the idea of her wanting desperately to connect.
I love that you get that impression, because that was always my impression from every picture or video I saw of her, is that she was sort of protruding. There's just something, even when she's being quiet or she's not allowed to sort of be very articulate about whatever's going on with her, there is this really apparent friction happening, because she is somebody who really reaches out, but also cannot, like, she touches people, but she is untouchable. Do you know what I mean? She is somebody who is in, like, always this place that is craving. I just always feel like she's in a sort of open, and like in a metaphorical way, her mouth is always open. Her eyes are always open. There's always something that's like, please, please. And even when things are like more tumultuous, she still feels like she leans into and not away from that friction.
Yeah, she's always open, and it's almost her bad misfortune that she is married into a family that is very closed. That friction is really well played by you in the film. I wonder, just as a general idea, does acting start from empathy? Does it start from that idea of wanting to connect?
Yeah, I think like any art form, really, in
general. Like, not everyone has a sort of compulsion to express in a way that is not straightforward. If you take someone's ability to just speak their truth away from them, it hurts anyone. But you take that away from somebody who has like an incredibly rich inner life and somebody who really wants to externalize that, and it's like watching someone be tortured. It's like the tortured artist thing really does come from that cliche is real, you know?
Yeah. This idea of not being able to express. And I feel an enormous sense of empathy from your performance of Diana. And that's not always the case. There is the larger mythology about her being the people's princess and everyone knowing her, but in a way, she's very unknowable. So a question to you, was there something private that you kept to yourself in your research about Diana that you wanted to keep just for you?
No, definitely not. No, in fact, I guess, you know, this sort of imagined 3 days allowed us to, in a very unspecific way, touch every part of her life. In doing the montage, we incorporated an energy and a feeling of kind of like a, it's like maybe the moment before you die or the moment before you have to make a huge decision. It's like your life kind of flashes before you. And every moment that got you to this place kind of just becomes physical. And in a split second, this memory kind of washes. I tried to shove absolutely every single molecule that I absorbed, even if it was just in my weird fantasies. I just got such a ground shaking impression of her. Like, the impact that she had on me became physical. And I don't think that I could have not shown that. This is like a very cheesy way of putting it, but that type of light, no matter where it's being refracted, reflects. You become close to her even as an idea, and it just like shines on you. And I wasn't trying to hide anything.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that clarity. Thank you. And I understand what you mean. Like, when you embody that character so much, the light has to come out somehow. Mm. And I get that. I understand too that I'm such a huge fan of Pablo Larraín's work just in general. And I've been watching it for years and years, long before Jackie actually. And I wonder, given that we've seen so much about Princess Diana, what was it about Pablo's approach and his approach to you that said, yeah, I want to work on this particular project? What was his vision that attracted you?
It's funny. You always try and find answers to questions when you are asked them. And sometimes you have to like fill in blanks and find words for things that actually are just more feeling based. Mm-hmm. It was the sound of his voice over the phone. He was so confident and sure that I should be doing this movie with him, and I was not going to tell him no. But when he presented the idea, I was like, this is crazy. I think you're crazy. I'm like, you know, I'm 5'5". I'm from Los Angeles. I have green eyes. I was like, what are you talking about? This is like, maybe you could find someone a little bit who would have an easier job doing this. He's like, I think how difficult it's going to be for you is what's going to be interesting about it. And I also really loved that he wasn't going to regurgitate a story that we all know, and that it was going to be a kind of meditation. And I think that Pablo's perspective has so much compassion in it because of how extreme it is. I think to honor an internal experience, to really honor a woman's feeling, all of the things that make you feel crazy in the moment. When you're going through trauma, sometimes internally that landscape is crazy. And instead of talking about it, he actually represented those in pictures. You know what I mean? Like, instead of being like, I just feel like ripping off my necklace and eating it, it's like, well, then rip it off and eat it. Do you know what I mean? It's like, mm-hmm. I think that is such a, especially from a guy's perspective, like, it is just a really beautiful way to honor her and her feelings. It was, I just thought it was a really stunning way in.
I understand exactly what you mean about responding to someone's voice and the confidence, especially when you're going to collaborate with them artistically. And I know how rare it is. I feel like we're in a little bit of a mini golden age with men stepping up and actually listening to women and making films. I think about Licorice Pizza, and I think about there have been actually a lot of films this year where, you know, really strong women perspectives coming from men and doing that kind of work that they should be doing. That said, you are so perfect for this role. And I want to ask you in a more technical sense, given the fact that you are from California and maybe don't resemble Diana, how much of the physical transformation and the vocal transformation and the accent and all the technical things, how important was that to you? Or was it more a question of starting with the interior?
So I knew about this movie for like a year and a half before we actually started touching it. And that is, I got to tell you, the biggest looming thing I've ever had in my life. I almost resent Pablo for telling me so early before we actually started doing it, because I was like, do you understand I didn't sleep? But it gave me the time to read everything. And I didn't need to educate myself, because everyone's perspective is different, and everyone wrote a memoir and all of them cancel each other out. But all of the research kind of allowed me to become, I don't know, like to kind of possess it in a way that, even as an outsider, everyone feels like they own everyone invested feels like they own their sort of little part of that story. They always, like, everyone has an opinion. I do too. I needed to figure out how to, like, emotionally protect her. I needed to like her. I needed to, like, fall in love with her, kind of, and be like, I will do anything to make sure that my impression of you is the one that comes through, because I see you really clearly. I just see her through my own lenses. We all do, you know? So luckily I had this really beautifully talented coach, and we worked for 4 months on the accent. And before I actually started living and breathing it, I couldn't picture it. It's like learning how to do a backflip, or like learning how to, like, play an instrument. You can't do it. You know, you don't learn it overnight. So I was, you know, the first time I tried it on, I was like, this is just absurd. And I have, like, a problem rehearsing too, because I really honor the moment in which things come together. And it's hard to, like, mess with that until it's, like, the moment. Yeah, I don't know. I think she has such a particular way of communicating. It's not just the accent and the sort of daunting nature of how particular that is, but, like, the way that she speaks is everything, because she is so muzzled. And so it's never really what she's saying, it's how she's saying it. And she's always communicating in tonal range. She just has a million different voices. And to kind of identify those and place them and find different ways to kind of be every version of her, even though it only took place over 3 days, was, I don't know, this, like, very wild distillation period. And it was definitely me and Pablo and William Conacher, who is our coach. It was like we had three, it was like we were like this three, we all played her. It was like the three of us kind of cultivating and shepherding along.
Playing her. And then also, I'm noticing in your performance, there are so many moments when it seems like Diana herself is playing someone. I think about the moments that she has with her children, and that their comfort zone is, in a way, also a game. It's like an additional performance. My first connection to Diana, and I'm going to date myself here, was learning that her favorite band was my favorite band. It was Duran Duran. And she met Duran Duran. And I couldn't believe how cool that was. And I wonder also if you listened to the music that she liked.
So, like, we did this montage every single day, right? At the end of every day, we did this, like, meditative therapy session in which I, like, put on an outfit and, like, wandered around the grounds, or flounced and danced around the grounds, whatever the song sort of brought out of the moment. And whatever the day kind of brought into it was what the scene became, or whatever. And so Pablo was playing a lot of the Talking Heads, Miles Davis, Sinead O'Connor. My whole playlist was just like ballad, just like Phil Collins on the bathroom floor. Like, yeah.
I'm revealing myself to be very uncool about the Duran Duran stuff, but that's what I love that about her. I loved how she embraced that.
Yeah. I mean, I guess, like, nowadays she probably would have called herself basic, but that just means, like, she's normal. And, I mean, look, we even have, like, an actual scene where Diana calls herself out as being, like, really kind of straight down the line. And yeah, she was, you know, not to, again, just sound, like, totally cheesy, but it was the first time people ever saw themselves reflected in that family. It was the first time anyone ever felt touched by that family. And it was shocking. I mean, like, Stephen talks about the moment that he saw all of his countrymen just, like, weeping openly. And he was like, never in my life. It literally, the impact, you know, it's like we talk about it now and we're, like, kind of used to it as a concept, but, like, that is crazy if you really think about that.
Yeah, that's a radical idea, making yourself accessible when it can be so predatory in that direction. I want very much to give you the opportunity to shout out people that you worked with on this, maybe costume, hair people, that really helped you find Diana.
Jacqueline Duran is, like, a virtuoso. Like, honestly, she's somebody who, yeah, she's a costumer. She builds costumes, but she also, like, she is such a storyteller in the way that she places things and the way that she energetically feels. Like, she literally designs skin for you. the amount of integrity that those costumes had was mind-blowing. And obviously, for this, so completely essential. Guy Hendricks created an environment that was the stuff of fantasy and nightmare. It didn't look anything like real Sandringham. And, you know, we take a lot of like creative liberties, but not because it's more interesting to tell the story this way, but because sometimes things don't feel the way they look. And for us, it was like everyone leaned so far into what must this felt like versus like what was real. And literally like my makeup artist could have done like a fake nose. She could have put contacts and covered my eyes. But like the whole thing was that all of the blood in her body is just so close to the surface of her skin. If we covered any of that up, like I think everyone just knew the assignment. Like it was public. And that's, again, like that's a real director. He just harnessed all of our energy and just went like, fucking go. And we were just like literally outrunning each other the entire time. It was like when you work with people that good, especially because everything was set up for me, like my stage was set and then I got there and I was like, okay, cool. So now I have to do a good job. But it's nice because you sort of stand on your tippy toes. It's like you continually kind of go like, oh man, well, he's killing it. I better get it together and try and outdo him.
I love that definition of acting, not to have a definition, but the idea that prosthetics or contacts would actually obscure your art and what you're really doing. And there's something that's very unvarnished about what you're doing, which I very much appreciate. Thanks. It's a real performance. And I'm wondering too, this maybe as an aside though, during this campaign, have there been other Oscar performances that you've really resonated with that you appreciate and admire?
Yeah. Oh my God. I mean, Alana in Licorice Pizza is mind blowing. She's never been in a movie before. And she is doing so much she's just very, very beautiful in the movie. And what she's doing is not easy. As somebody who, you know, I don't know, I'm an actor. I see stuff maybe a little differently. I think that the amount of story she's telling so subtly, I just was blown away by her performance. I mean, Parallel Mothers kind of like knocked my socks off. I just can't. It's one of the most heartbreaking performances of all. I think that all of these, they're incomparable. And so that's why it's really silly to sit here and be like, so who's the best? Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah. And also, so that's different. Not how we think. You know, we don't think that, you know, I don't even think that way. And I'm supposed to. It's like, yeah. But I do know, too, that you're making your own film or going to be directing your own film, and you've worked with some of the best directors for years and years. I am curious, do you have a take on this idea that the Oscars are going to be giving out 8 of their categories during the pre-show? I mean, do you have any thoughts about that?
The Oscars is a television show. You know what I mean? Like people across the United States that don't know for visual effect, you know what I mean? Like, I don't know. I wish that it wasn't. I mean, we're part of an industry, dude. Art and commerce has always wrestled and struggled, but they don't exist without each other. And I wish that what I loved was what everyone loved, but also I'm a film nerd and I completely understand why. Having said that, like, I don't know. I would love to be able to like redesign the wheel, but I don't really know what that would look like. And I mean, look, I would say everyone should just like talk for less time, maybe do like less little things in between, just do the awards. Like I covet and revere the people that make movies. If I wasn't an actor, I would be doing anything to get close to it. And so of course I think that we should honor them publicly and out loud, but you know, I don't know. I can't. Yeah. Also, should we have a monarchy? Let's answer all the big questions right now. Let's fix everything. The monarchy, should we be doing that too? I don't know.
I like the idea of engaging with the big questions. And I feel like in a way, this performance interrogates that as well. Can you talk to me a little bit about what it was like working with Sally Hawkins and Timothy Spall? Their performances, I think, bring out two very specific sides of Diana, and they're such great actors.
They're like otherworldly actors. I think that Sally Hawkins is from a different planet. I get these emails from her that are like written in verse, like little bird talk. When we were working together, I was like, it was like she was a figment of my imagination. She was so good. And also within the movie, she does sort of play this like angelic, almost figmenty type character that sort of could be there or not be there. And also to have her and Tim just be such seminal sort of UK actors, as somebody who is such an outsider in this, to feel bolstered and supported by them was like hugely alleviating when we first started, because they were like just so nice to me. They were like, no one else in the world could do this. I was like, tell me that again. Tell me again. Yeah. They're just really beautiful people and also performers, but it starts with being like really, really beautiful souls. Yeah.
I am very, very curious about one specific moment in the film with the pearls. I know you probably get asked this a lot, but that is just that's a moment where the whole psychological conception really crystallizes and you feel the pain and that, what are you actually chewing in that? That's such a crazy moment.
So in the script, the script is very precisely written, and, you know, you could have directed that scene in a number of ways. He pushed that so far that day. We just shot and shot and shot, and it could have been like a quick flash, you know. Embedding Anne Boleyn in that scene was not in the script. He really leaned into the nightmare aspect of it to the point that I was like, now I really know what movie I'm doing, because the surreality of it is not a sort of slight suggestion. It's like, it's all encompassing. And they were M&Ms. To be specific, they were literally just like chocolate covered, like candy coated M&Ms basically. And I was really, really blown away. That was the day that I was like, oh, okay, I understand what this movie is.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful piece of work. I love that it goes into that kind of psychodrama. And those are the moments that let me attach to it. As a final question to you, and thank you for these thoughtful answers and for indulging my weird questions.
No.
Everyone has been experiencing this lockdown now for 2+ years and, you know, watching stuff at home and desperate to connect in a way, just like Diana. What did you get resonance from and feel complete by? Was there a series that you binged? Was there some movie that you came into contact? Was there a piece of art or something that said, this is going to help me survive this moment?
Me and my girlfriend read East of Eden out loud, like cover to cover. She had never read it before, and it's just like, it's kind of like my Bible. I literally, it's like a sacred text for me. And you never share, reading is a personal experience. You do it alone typically. And, I was like, dude, we should do this together. Like every single word out loud, did that. And actually Pablo kind of saved my life a little bit. He was like, hey, you want to make a move? You want to be a director? Direct something. What are you just like drinking yourself to death and getting really good at pool? That's what you're going to do with the pandemic. So he hooked me up, and actually he was producing this thing called Homemade for Netflix. And I made like a little piece about the kind of spirally and insomniac ridden time that I was having. And, kind of like, well, the movie's small and whatever, it's just a baby movie, but like, it was just about this like daunting kind of like, I don't know if I'm asleep or awake and I can't get any work done feeling. And that was satisfying. Art saves, man. Saves lives. What we do is essential.
I think it is. And I've never heard about reading a novel out loud with someone you love like that. That's such a great idea. I'm going to have to try that with my wife.
Oh my God. Honestly, we're going to do it. Like, we're going to do one book a year now.
It's just, it sounds kind of sexy. I mean, it sounds like who knows how someone's going to respond to that? That's wild.
We also read Wuthering Heights cover to cover out loud every single word, and you like cry together, and you go like, there's no, even when you're sitting, that's the cool thing about sitting in a movie theater with everyone is you go like, look, I know I'm emotional right now, but like, I just feel way more emotional because we're all here crying. And like,
do you trade off the roles? Do you both do
no,
Kathy?
No, no,
do you-
all me. I'm a control freak. Every word. I can't listen. I have zero retention skills. So like I was the reader.
Okay. I got it. Well, I love that idea. And I am so moved by these really thoughtful answers. Thank you so much for your time. I know you're very busy, and good luck with the rest of the campaign and everything. I enjoyed this very much. Thank you.
Oh, cool. Me too. Dude, thank you for doing this.
Thanks again to Kristen Stewart for sitting down with us. Spencer is available on Hulu right now for streaming. That's all from us today. Thank you for joining us on this episode of The Awardist. Please subscribe and listen along every week wherever you get your podcasts. Rate us, tell us what you think, share it with your friends. You can also head to ew.com/awardist for complete coverage of this year's Oscar race, Follow me on Twitter at Josh Rothkopf, Clarissa at ClarissaNYC1, and Leah at Leah Batts.
This episode of the Awardist podcast is hosted by Clarissa Cruz and Josh Rothkopf, produced by Chanel Johnson and Sammy Junio, edited and mixed by Sammy Junio. Full episode transcripts are available at EW.com. Thanks for listening.